Paris. Yeah. Outside of Paris. He built his own Paris, and it cost a fortune.
And so that's, these are the films of Jacques Tati, Mononc, and Playtime.
Thanks, Matthew. Thanks, Lisa. And thank you for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday, so until then, keep watching the screens.
Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is listener sponsored. That's right, 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. Right now, during the last week of our spring membership drive, your support can go even further. Contribute today at bit.ly/KBOO, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $20,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Maximize the impact of your support for KBOO right now and help us reach our $60,000 goal by May 25th. Thanks so much.
Want to be in the know for all things Ghost of Hollywood? Check out our website at theghostofhollywood.com for all the newest episodes and updates.
And don't forget to listen every other Friday live on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. If you're not local, you can also find us live on KBOO.fm. And while you're there, please consider donating to Portland's very own listener-powered radio.
I'm Grace Gerling Medicine Eagle Reed. I am broadcasting Negotiating Dramatic Events, a new show on KBOO, the third Wednesday at 9 a.m. I am a social justice activist since the 1960s. The purpose of the show is to make life more wonderful for me and the people around me. And I'm 80, and I'm going to take my elderliness and share what I have found so that everybody can be seen, heard, and understood. Negotiating Dramatic Events, the third Wednesday at 9 a.m. Thanks for tuning in. Really appreciate KBOO.
This is Cesar Chavez. You're listening to KBOO, listener-sponsored radio.
Good morning. You're listening to That Vegan Show. I'm your host, Melissa Lesniak. Today, we're going to be talking to two recent graduates of the Lewis and Clark Law School. But before we get to that, don't forget that we are almost at the end of KBOO's spring membership drive, focusing on the postmodern, the avant-garde, and the alternative. To support KBOO in this way, go to bit.ly/KBOO or text KBOO to 44321 to become a monthly sustaining member today. Help us reach our fundraising goal of $60,000. And we are in the last few days of the drive, so please consider supporting shows like this one, That Vegan Show, on KBOO. Now we are welcoming Katie Bester. She's a recent graduate from the Lewis and Clark Law School with a certificate in animal law. a little bit about Katie. She is dedicated to animal rights, which began in high school and has become an integral part of her personal and professional life. Prior to starting her legal career, Katie earned her BA from the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse, where she majored in writing and rhetorical studies with a double minor in legal studies and public administration. During college, Katie was awarded a research grant to travel to Australia, where she worked with and learned from various animal advocacy groups. Thanks for being here today, Katie.
Thank you for having me.
And we also have Eric Sugarman. Eric focuses on the nexus of animal law, environmental law, and transformative justice. He was born and raised in North Carolina, and he graduated from the University of North Carolina with a degree in sustainability and geography. Thanks for being here today, Eric.
Yeah, excited to chat with you, Melissa.
Eric, would you like to tell us a little bit more about yourself, and then we'll go back to Katie, too?
Sure. So, like your introduction stated, I'm from North Carolina. It was kind of during college that I really began to focus more intensely on the food system and on sort of the myriad issues that plague transition to a food system that's sustainable and equitable and regenerative and compassionate to people and planet and animals. And being from North Carolina and growing up an hour from the epicenter of sort of the hog CAFO occupation of the Eastern Coastal Plain communities of North Carolina, I just really started to, I started to appreciate the need to hone in on the industrial animal agricultural system as sort of the, what I regard as the Death Star of the food system, that like the orbit that industrial animal agriculture creates, erects, reflects, and perpetuates so much additional harm. That's sort of where I wanted to focus, was food. I graduated from college and spent a few years apprenticing on regenerative farms around the country, and was fully proceeding on a path to become a farmer myself. Was already looking at degraded old cornfields that I was excited to lease and try to regenerate. And it was really like during those experiences that I also started to appreciate how many structural barriers that are legal and political in nature stand in the way of a more systemic transition away from industrial agriculture and towards something that is more sustainable. And so that was what led me to want to pursue a legal education and see how I might be able to leverage legal tools in service of dismantling industrial animal agriculture and industrial agriculture more broadly, and really wanting to make myself useful in being able to effectively advocate within these movements that are focused on those spaces. That's sort of what brought me here to now be 3 days removed from law school graduation. And yeah, now looking at what's next for how I can apply my education in service of people and planet and animals.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And we certainly need those skills and, you know, the education behind that. Katie, would you like to share a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, thank you. Similar to Eric, I just started questioning kind of our food systems, and more specifically in high school, I definitely started questioning my relationship with animals generally, and obviously that meant that I had to question what I was putting on my plate and how those beans got there. And so after going vegan, I in college, I just felt like that wasn't enough. And I knew that I wanted to dedicate my life to protecting animals, which after, you know, a pretty quick Google search, I found Lewis and Clark Law School. And so throughout college, I just really focused on getting good grades so I could get into law school. And all my English papers were dedicated to different animal rights topics. And I'm sure a lot of my professors were getting sick of that. But then I got accepted to Lewis and Clark and moved from Wisconsin to Portland. And 3 years later, here I am, like Eric said, three days removed, and it feels pretty surreal.
I bet. Yeah, thank you for sharing that and being part of this movement and getting the education and knowledge and experience you need to, both of you, to make a difference from, different angles. Like the systemic angle is really needed. Sometimes there's just not enough of us on the ground who are vegan that can make the kind of changes that need to be.
Totally.
Okay. So in mid-March, I had the pleasure of coming over to see Miyoko Shinner that was put on at Lewis and Clark Law School. And you were telling me that's Animal Law Week in March. Katie, can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, so Eric and I were fortunate enough to be the 2023-2024 co-directors of the Animal Legal Defense Fund student chapter at Lewis and Clark Law School. And so what this entailed was putting on different events and organizing different projects with our student, with other animal law students. And so part of that is Animal Law Week, which happens every spring. And this year we focused on the future of animal law and what that means in a broader sense. And so one of the days we invited Miyoko Shinner to come speak to not only the Lewis and Clark community, but we really wanted it to be a broader event that we could welcome the Portland community to lead a broader discussion. And so I don't know if you remember, but we were really excited about the format of the event because it wasn't just Miyoko speaking, it was Q&A, which allowed more audience engagement and different perspectives to be shared about how we move forward as we are trying to shift our food system and what that will look like.
Yeah, I really liked the format, how she had five questions for us and she would discuss each one of them herself too, but there was quite a bit of audience participation, which was really different. It wasn't just like going to see a lecture.
Yeah, and it came, after a time of pretty big shift in Miyoko's life after she ended her relationship with her company. And so we were really interested as well just to hear from her and her perspective on what she was going to do now and how she's going to continue to be participating in the movement.
Yeah, I was really glad to hear about that too and hear, just right from her personally about how, her thoughts about the different industries and how women are treated sometimes in these industries. So,
right. And even more broadly, it's still sort of an open question about what is the pathway through which we advance the interest and lives of animals. And for a lot of people, it's still market-based solutions that are the most scalable in their impact. And so we were so grateful to be able to welcome Miyoko in the wake of this transformative experience that she went through as someone that was really like the quintessential success story of a social justice minded company founder who sought to create impact from her product, from vegan artisan vegan cheese, that she basically like revolutionized that whole market. And to see that she got so big that it became impracticable to continue to guide the company based on a mission, and it became so much more about the profit. And so I was so jazzed to have Miyoko in the room and to get to share space with her and hear her perspective, because I think it's so unique as someone that sort of, quote unquote made it, and to come out on the other side of that convinced that what we need is not more market-based solutions, but we need, sort of those more systemic legal and policy solutions to be underpinning the transition, to a vegan food system.
Right. Like I definitely felt like it was new information that I hadn't heard before and I hadn't thought about in that way. So it was really valuable. And then you also had some vegan, local vegan cheese here. And that was from Vetopia, yes?
Yes, it was. Okay. Did you get to try some?
Yes, I went back later and bought some more of that lavender cheese. So unique and different.
I know. Huge shout out to Ryan and Brittany for coming to cater the event. We love Vetopians, so it was awesome to get to showcase, you know, the Portland artisan vegan cheese scene at the Miyoko event. That was really special.
Yeah, it was quite a spread for sure. Okay. Eric, did you want to kind of break down the different components of like the Animal Legal Defense Fund and how it, you know, works with the law school?
Sure. Yeah, I would take one step back and just initially say the Animal Legal Defense Fund is it's an animal legal advocacy nonprofit. And ALDF, sort of the nonprofit and not the student chapter, is focused on using legal tools and legislative advocacy to advance the welfare and lives of animals. And it was in 1993 that Animal Legal Defense Fund set out to start these student chapters that they felt would be sort of like an incubator to be able to spread animal law, because it still remains such a niche focus of law. And so starting in 1993, Lewis and Clark's Animal Legal Defense Fund student chapter was the first of its kind. And, you know, we're 30 plus years later with hundreds of members that are still active, and with a long list of alumnus that, you know, still support the organization. And so we as a student chapter are sort of focused on trying to educate ourselves and others concerning the issues and laws that affect animals. And we want to influence positive change both on our campus, like within our campus community, and in the broader Portland area and nationally when we can. We have projects that we're engaged on of various scope, you know, from campus initiatives to national advocacy campaigns. So I'd break our work at our student chapter up into three bins broadly. We do outreach and education. And so the Miyoko event that came as part of Animal Law Week would be, you know, a prime example of a speaker event that we organized to be able to provide an educational experiential opportunity. You know, and reach out to our community and be like, come to the law school for this evening and let's all engage together on this topic, you know, that is animal centered in its focus. And Animal Law Week is, you know, an extension of that. More broadly, we're just trying to create opportunities to learn more sort of about emergent topics in animal law and learn about advocacy that's happening in our area in Portland or around the country, around the world. We work with other organizations on campus to try to highlight the intersections between animal law and other legal focuses. So we collaborated with the Environmental Law Caucus and with the Northwest Environmental Defense Center to put on events that were focused more on intersectional issues, you know, sort of just to draw more attention to the importance of paying attention to the sort of the animal legal implications, you know, within other areas of law, like environmental law, where they're not necessarily, the experiences and lives of animals are not centered in that advocacy work.
Right.
Our second bin would be community building events. And that's more about trying to develop a community of future animal law practitioners on our own campus. And so for things like that, we would host vegan potlucks and documentary movie screenings where we could all just come together and share space, share food and be in community, because it, like I was saying, animal law continues to be such a niche practice area that it is important to me and important to us and important to our organization. If we want to sustain our advocacy efforts, we need to be in community, because the issues we seek to address the systems we seek to dismantle in our advocacy for animals are huge, are massive. We're talking about entire paradigms that this movement seeks to topple. You know, if we are to institute systems that are ethically defensible in the way that concerns non-human animals. And so it's daunting work, and it's important that we have people to lean on that are also doing this work. And so that's a really important goal for us, is just to build community at Lewis and Clark Law School of people that are interested in advancing the welfare and legal status of non-human animals. And then our last bin is pro bono volunteer opportunities. We build out projects where the members of Lewis and Clark's Animal Legal Defense Fund student chapter, which is similar to any other organization on campus, we're membership based. So we'll have our listserv, we'll sort of host monthly or bi-monthly all chapter meetings where we'll come together, talk about what's going on, what we have planned, solicit ideas, potential projects, vote on potential speakers to come in, things like that. And so pro bono opportunities are a chance for students to get to spend their time and energy doing actual animal law related work. And so for example, this year we collaborated with Farm Sanctuary, which is another 501c3 nonprofit, like animal legal advocacy organization. And we were working on developing a humane education curriculum supplement that could be used in middle school and high schools. Yeah, so that's just one example of some of the offerings that we tried to provide to our members, where, because law school can be a pretty gnarly experience some of the time. And sure. So to get to have opportunities where we can be really like furthering the work of the movement, you know, not just reading case books, feels really good and is important to us. And then I lied. We have four bins probably that instead of three. I think internal projects are a bit distinct from the sort of outreach and education component. That was more about trying to support more broadly a vegan lifestyle on our campus for all folks, even if someone doesn't necessarily want to focus their legal work in the animal protection movement. For people that live a vegan lifestyle, you know, and deserve to have an opportunity to practice that lifestyle on our campus, we spent a lot of time and energy and in meetings with our campus administrators and with faculty and staff trying to reform our campus dining options. We did a lot of work with Katie Contrell and the Greener by Default organization, which is an awesome nonprofit that's working to shift sort of the default options for like institutional dining to plant-based options. And they've been really efficacious in their work, super, super effective model, and makes it really easy to get wins. So we are working with them just to try to offer more vegan options in our campus dining. We've also addressed like what's being sold in our vending machines. We were just trying to be as granular as possible with like, where are the easy low-hanging fruits where no one is going to notice if what's in the vending machine is vegan, as long as it tastes good, especially if it's nutritious and provides, you know, like a positive health benefit. We think it's a win-win to try to reduce the amount of animal products that involve animal cruelty or implicate cruelty towards animals on our campus. We are the foremost animal law program in the world. I think we should, and environmental program too. And those two, that's inextricable, you know, from the animal protection movement. And so we're of the mind that we should be walking the walk as a campus. And there's no reason why we can't shift towards a fully vegan campus. And that was sort of our position. And it's very much going to be a multi-year battle.
Sure. You know,
there's definitely a lot of resistance internally, but we had a lot of movement in the right direction this year, and we're really excited about the chapter's continued efforts there, because we really do think we can that can be a win. I think that redefines our campus as like a more overtly vegan or vegan friendly space.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you're making some progress, because before the pandemic, I was belonging to a few groups where we were trying to see if we could do something along those same lines in Portland Public Schools, because they don't have a ton of options for vegans and in their cafeterias. So it's interesting for me to hear how it's working for you there. Sounds like you've made some progress.
A little bit less progress than would have been hoped for with the administration itself, but where we had a lot of success was independent, like volunteered agreements with other campus organizations, with other student groups. So it was volunteering to, procure only vegan food at their internal events, things like that. Meatless Mondays were instituted on our campus. So every Monday, like one out of 5 days of dining was all vegan. And that felt like a non-trivial win.
Yeah, so not just Meatless Monday, but it was actually a vegan Monday.
Right.
That's great. I guess I was curious about the environmental, groups, because in the past that sometimes like these kind of issues, animal issues and how they contribute to the environmental issues we have were pushed under the rug. Are you finding that there's more acceptance of that now?
I can touch on that a little bit, and then I think Eric can definitely add, because he has much more experience in environmental law. Just from my experience this year, I wouldn't say it's necessarily a resistance to like being vegan or to addressing the issues, but I think that animal law is unique in that there is a personal component of it, in that it is many times a part of people's identity and lifestyle that they live, whereas environmental law doesn't necessarily have that same kind of commitment. This year in particular, I wouldn't say it was completely our efforts on campus, but I would like to think we played a small role in it. The environmental law symposium focused on CAFOs, or factory farms, and their impacts on the environment, and all the food that they served there was vegan, which was really exciting for us to see.
Definitely.
Yeah, and I think that's a really astute point about the uniqueness of animal law being guided by a moral imperative, where I think that's present in the practice of environmental law as well, but it's not so direct and front and center. But I think, the combined animal law symposium, and it wasn't just that the environmental law review focused on the industrial animal agriculture system, but the animal law review and the environmental law review collaborated to have a two-day symposium, where there was a focus on the CAFO system, and then there was a focus on what is being done to use litigation as a tool in combating and opposing the CAFO system. So that was really cool to see, and I think it's demonstrative of a lot of movement in the right direction, though it still feels like there, I would personally say, in my experience, there does feel like there's some continued resistance on the part of the environmental law program, to fully embrace the interactions, intersections, interrelationship between sort of the like environmental protection and animal protection.
I have a question for you. Correct me if I'm wrong, but in your environmental law classes, what was factory farming ever brought up as an issue?
Not in and of itself. There was, I remember in my environmental law class, my second year of law school, we read one case about a CAFO that violated the Clean Water Act. But the main issue of that case, if I remember correctly, was not so much about, it didn't take issue with the CAFO system. It was about is this a point source? Like, is this a discharge for the purposes of Section 301 of the Clean Water Act? So without getting too deep into the weeds, it was like, yes, we read a case, you know, a lawsuit, a judicial opinion that involved CAFOs, but that was really the extent. In environmental justice, which is in the environmental law program, we had an entire day that was dedicated to understanding the human impacts of the CAFO system. So it's like CAFO occupied communities, environmental justice communities, low income and communities of color, and the way that they are impacted by CAFOs. And we briefly talked about the implications of intensive confinement on animal welfare, but it still doesn't rise to the level of honoring the sentience and moral relevancy of the animals themselves. And to my knowledge, of all of the environmental law coursework that I took while at Lewis and Clark, and I got the environmental law certificate in addition to the animal law certificate, so like quite a bit of coursework, I think only one professor that I had eats a vegan diet.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, yeah, folks are comfortable, you know, in their own lane. Because it's still like, yeah, I think that there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. But like Katie said, there were some hopeful highlights, I think, that are demonstrative of movement in the right direction towards a more holistic embrace of the inextricable interconnections between animal law and environmental law.
So it sounds like some progress is made, but as usual, there's more to be made. And unfortunately, being vegan is not always super popular. So I wonder if that's part of it too, like that they want people to focus on some part of the environment, and if veganism is part of it, will that turn people off? I think one of you mentioned too, though, that people are just comfortable with eating what they're already eating too. So, you know, that's an issue with a lot of people. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to That Vegan Show here on KBOO Portland. Before we get back to the interview, I just want to take a moment to thank everyone who has supported KBOO's spring membership drive, focusing on the postmodern, the avant-garde, and the alternative. Visit us on the KBOO app, and while you're there, look for That Vegan Show and the donate button. And also, you can text KBOO to 44321. Every donation is appreciated. This is the last week of our drive, the last few days, actually. So please give at this time if you wanted to do that. Thank you. So we have been talking with Katie and Eric, who are recent graduates of the Lewis and Clark Law School. And they also both have certificates in animal law, which is a pretty unique program, and Eric also has a certificate in environmental law. So thanks again for being here, and I wanted to offer you the chance while we're talking, if you want to give out the website, if people want to look more into the programs and resources that we've been talking about.
Sure. It's kind of a lengthy URL, but if you just navigate to Lewis and Clark Law School, I mean, just okay, typing that into Google, the Lewis and Clark Law School Animal Legal Defense Fund student chapter we have a website page that's embedded within sort of the student org page. And then there's a lot more information about CALS, the Center for Animal Legal Studies, which sort of administers the animal law program at our school, and the animal law program itself on the website. I can send it to you to post in the show notes, if show notes are a thing.
Yes, I think I have looked that up, and I will post it on the KBOO page for this. There's an episode page for each show, so I will definitely post any links that we are talking about there.
Awesome. Thanks, Melissa.
Yeah.
And I will give a shout out to the Lewis and Clark ALDF social media, especially on Instagram. I would say that's where most of like the updates and events are posted. And so if you want, like, for example, for like the Miyoko event, that was shared there as well. And so that is definitely something to follow if you're interested in Lewis and Clark ALDF's work.
What's the handle for that Instagram, Katie? Do you know?
LCALDF.
Nice. Okay. So yeah, and if you're just tuning in, ALCF stands for Animal Legal Defense Fund. So it's LCALDF is the handle on Instagram. And yeah, I didn't have any trouble finding it, like you were saying, Eric, just kind of navigating to the Lewis and Clark page and looking for animal law. Were there any more of the projects you wanted to talk about?
I guess one thing we didn't mention that we cherish are our visits to farmed animal sanctuaries uh-huh. around the Portland area. At least once a semester, we put on a work party where our members can join us for a day of mucking barns and helping to repair fences and mulching, or really whatever the sanctuaries need help with. And then we get to spend a few hours hanging out with the residents, all the animals that are living there. And that's always one of our favorite days of the year.
Yeah, that was definitely both of those days. This year were my highlights of my law school career. I obviously started on this journey because I love, appreciate, and respect animals. And pretty soon into law school, I realized that I spend absolutely no time with animals doing this work. And so it's really nice to just get back out there and feel useful, because as you're going through law school, you don't really have an opportunity to see the fruits of our labor, because we are not able to really, you know, work on anything yet. And we're definitely kind of in it for the long haul. And so just being able to lay down some fresh hay and seeing a pig snuggle up in it is really valuable.
Yeah. And yeah. I would add to that, I think it's so rare to be able to spend time, especially with farmed animals, in a space where they're not under duress and can be themselves and express themselves. And so, you know, it's something I would recommend to anyone listening to this program. There are sanctuaries probably not too far from your area, listeners. And if you want to go spend some time with some very happy farmed animals, I mean, it's a great place to get to go experience them in all of their beauty. It's, you know, it's so different to see pigs playing in a field after they've been, you know, liberated and offered a space of sanctuary, as it is to see them trapped inside of the CAFO system. And so I think any person who is eating vegan or lives a vegan lifestyle, you know, owes it to themselves to go hang out with some happy farmed animals, because it's really special.
I totally agree. Which sanctuaries did you go to this year?
This year we went to Lighthouse Sanctuary and uh-huh. Green Acres Sanctuary, which are both about an hour and 15-ish minutes outside of Portland. And they're pretty often accepting volunteers to come help out and hang with the animals.
Yeah, I was at the Flipside Market this weekend, which is a...
Oh, I was there too.
Oh, were you there? It was a vegan market, and I was tabling for Northwest Veg, but we were kind of in the row with a lot of different animal sanctuaries. We were right next to Green Acres, and I've been to Green Acres and Lighthouse, but before the pandemic, so I've been, you know, found out about some of their events. Out to Pasture was there, and some other sanctuaries. So I was like, yes, I need to get back out there. It's just so weird how it feels like the pandemic kind of changed your life so much. Totally. You have to kind of get back into doing those things you used to do. Yeah, that sounds like a win-win for the animals and for all of you to, you know, get outside and feel like you said, feel like useful and helpful to the animals, and then also get to spend some time with them. Okay, so let's step back a little bit and talk more about what animal law is.
Well, I guess I can just start with an experience of mine that I think can help kind of answer this question, start us off. I was recently in an interview for a job at a public interest law firm, and in the most sincere way, the interviewer asked me what animal law was. And this was an attorney in Portland, and I was taken completely off guard because obviously, you know, having spent 3 years in animal law, you just, in your own kind of bubble, you just assume everybody knows what it is. But even in Portland, it is definitely a new field that people aren't aware of. And so I answered the interviewer with, well, it's pretty much a part of every area of animal law. And I think Eric would agree. For example, like public or consumer protections is a huge part of what animal law is, as far as like what different labels say and on animal products, as well as environmental law, as we've talked about. And basically, obviously, animal law is about protecting and improving the laws for the interests of animals, but it's also about the intersection with every other area of law and how that affects animals every day.
Yeah, and a lot of that is by necessity because there are so few laws that are focused on the interests of animals. And so practitioners of animal law have had to be increasingly creative about what laws they're leveraging to try to advocate on behalf of non-human animals. I mean, I guess very broadly, I would describe animal law as the field of study and scholarship, practice and advocacy in which serving the best interests of non-human animals through the legal system is the primary goal. Mm-hmm. And because serving the interests of animals through the legal system is the primary goal, and we don't really have good laws on the books that allow us to do that work, like Katie said, we find legal hooks in consumer protection statutes and even in criminal law and in the Clean Water Act, you know, is one of the favorite environmental statutes of animal advocates. Because there really is not, I mean, the Animal Welfare Act, you know, is in name only targeting the welfare of animals. It's the loopholes, you know, you could fly an intergalactic spaceship through the loopholes of the Animal Welfare Act. And most animals are exempted, and most of the most common and egregious forms of animal cruelty are exempted as, you know, sort of standard practices that are accepted by the industries that exploit animals to profit from them. And so, yeah, it's interesting to focus on animal law as students of the law because we're sort of desperately in need of more laws on the books that are addressing the interests of non-human animals. We're also in a time politically where, like, the passage of laws, especially at the federal level, is not necessarily a politically pragmatic strategy and not something that should really even be an expectation for advocates. So practitioners of animal law have to be incredibly clever and strategic in the ways that they're leveraging existing laws to advocate on behalf of non-human animals and advance the interests of animals through the legal system. And a lot of that looks like coalition building and trying to be the voice inside of sort of the strategy rooms where maybe there's like a more overtly environmental lawsuit happening, but ALDF will be part of the coalition. And so there is a dedicated animal advocacy organization in the strategy room trying to inform, you know, the legal strategy that, say, will guide litigation against Tyson, you know, just for example. And so I think animal law continues to be somewhat nebulous, especially because it's still sort of an emergent practice area. Even within animal law, I think there's a lot of infighting and even confusion about the goals of the animal law as a practice. You know, is it, there's the classic like welfare versus rights dichotomy. It's like, what are we seeking to accomplish? Why did we go to law school and focus on animal law? How do we think we can leverage legal tools to serve the interests of animals? These are all questions I think we're forced to engage with sometimes on a daily basis, or at least, you know, over the course of our legal education. I think they remained and still remain really pressing questions for us as folks who went to law school and received legal training so that we could apply that training in service of non-human animals. It's like constantly just trying to, it's so iterative, trying to explore ways that we can make ourselves useful as advocates for animals.
Yeah, that's always a little frustrating when it's hard to kind of get on the same page with a large group of people.
Definitely.
Let's talk a little bit more about the different areas of animal law, if there's any we haven't touched on yet.
We can kind of discuss too, like what, at least in our experience, what we've been exposed to at Lewis and Clark. For example, a big focus of animal law in general is companion animal law and like anti-cruelty laws, because that is the area that has the most protection is for companion animals, because people tend to care more about the treatment of their companion animals. Other areas are wildlife, which involves animal trading, as well as just like hunting regulations and that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's aquatic animal law, so that's sort of focusing on animals that live their lives within bodies of water. There is, you know, broadly sort of the practice of animal law within a criminal law context, so prosecuting cruelty. You know, depending on one's relationship to the carceral state, it's like there are valid questions that can be posed about the efficacy or ethical defensibility of utilizing the carceral state to try to support the well-being of animals. But it's definitely something that I think has dramatically positively affected the lives of thousands and thousands of animals, to be able to use the law to pull them out of conditions where they're actively being harmed. There is sort of the law that Katie and I both spend a lot of time focusing on, that's farmed animal law, or like lack thereof. Like I said, I mean, there's really no laws on the books besides the 28-hour law that afford animals that are being transported like a break every 28 hours to get out and walk around for an hour, maybe. I don't remember the letter of the law, but other than that, I mean, there's just, yeah, very, very, very few protections for farmed animals. And, you know, by the numbers, I mean, we just in the United States alone raised and killed 10 billion plus individual animals in just in the food system just last year. And so in terms of like the sheer extent of harm and the sheer quantity of individuals who are exploited, you know, and living under such tragically oppressive conditions, I mean, the food system is definitely, you know, ground zero for exploitation of animals. And so that's sort of, and it's so intersectional, like Katie was saying earlier. I think it's a great place to be able to build coalitions, because the industrial animal agricultural model is not working for anyone except the few vertically integrated corporations that profit off of that system. And so it's somewhere that we think, and especially because there is such a direct, you know, cultural and individual emotional relationship to our food, I think affecting change in the food system, and especially when those changes are focused on reducing the amount of animals who are implicated in the food system, who are being raised and killed for food, I think that is, that's a vehicle for a heightened awareness, you know, sort of a raising of popular consciousness about the ways in which the defense of animals is also a defense of our planet and our bodies and our communities and our water and our air. And it's like, I think, a place where we can really see a lot of downstream impacts on the way people think about animals once we can really raise awareness about what's happening, you know, within a factory farm, because so many of us still have never even really stopped to think about where our food comes from, much less like who is being harmed in the production of our food.
Right. It just seems, and I mean, I always know I'm biased, but I think even an unbiased opinion would be that a lot of these systems are really, like you said, they're only benefiting a few people, and they're, you know, not advantageous to the environment, to our health, to the animals' health and welfare, to the people who have to work in those facilities. Like, they're just, seems like there's so many negatives, but...
Well, not only is it not advantageous, but it's actually untenable. You know, it is actively accelerating our own extinction event, and we can't continue in these systems. And so it really is, in my mind, a question of when we will divest from these systems that are killing us and are killing animals and are killing our planet. And so I think I've had to accept that the sort of line of work I've committed myself to, like, it might be, because, like I was saying initially, like, this is an entire paradigm that we're talking about dismantling. Mm-hmm. You know, we're to have a sort of interspecies justice that grounds our relationship to other animals. I mean, that's revolutionary. And so I think we might be looking at a multi-generational movement. And so it's, you know, gearing up to maybe not experience any like major changes in maybe the course of our career. I mean, you know, I desperately hope that that isn't the case, but I think we need to be considering the long game and to recognize that our advocacy is essential, even if we, like Katie was saying, don't see the fruits of our labor very often. And so figuring out ways to sustain ourselves when we are focused on such a harmful system like the industrial animal agriculture system, it's just it's so important, yeah, to continue focusing on our why, because I think burnout is fairly common in this space. And so, you know, as recent graduates that are looking at how we want to sculpt our trajectory as legal professionals, yeah, I think it's challenging and also exciting to think about how we can be in this for the long haul, because I think Katie and I, you know, both seek to dedicate our lives to this movement. And so just, you know, continue to wonder how to, and look for ways more actively than just wondering on how to sustain ourselves in this work.
And it's just so needed. And, you know, I'm always glad to see people who, you know, are using their intellect for, you know, something that is so needed and such a worthy type cause. And something you mentioned earlier kind of reminded me of when I talked to Northwest Animal Rights Network, if you're familiar with them, because, mm-hmm. Yeah, they were telling me that how they, you know, because the meetings are on Zoom now, like, they attend like the Washington wildlife meetings. And when you were saying about being clever about different things, you know, they're kind of in there, you know, shifting some ideas, not it's not an overnight change, but kind of getting into different arenas and shifting the ideas in there and building connections with people.
Right. Yeah. I think animal law is not just a legal tool in that sense. Like, animal law is a subversive force. that can illuminate contradictions and put pressure on the state and corporations and institutions and coalitions to, you know, be honest with themselves and to divest from morally inexcusable systems of structural violence. And it's, like you said, just to be in the room, I think, is a really important thing, and be able to offer that perspective. Because it's hard to be honest with ourselves when we are implicated in systems of harm. It's like really challenging to step back into being an observer and to own that, and then make changes in accordance with, you know, a more like morally defensible way of being.
That's true. Well, we're getting to the end of the episode. Is there anything else we want to touch upon before we wrap up?
I would like just to add that although it does feel very daunting, I think that anybody, you know, even those that haven't had the privilege and opportunity to go to law school can use the laws to help protect animals. And I think that knowing and understanding them are a really good tool and resource to help grow the movement, because a lot of times people are unaware of just how bad the situation is. I mean, I would say like one of the movement's biggest victories lately was the California case with Prop 12 and requiring forks sold in California had to come from producers that allowed their pigs to be able to turn around. And like that we are celebrating as a very big win. I think even people that aren't even remotely like aware of veganism or why people are vegan or any of the issues with industrial animal egg can see that as and recognize that that is not the way that we as society would like to treat animals. And so I just encourage people to use the laws and animal laws to help promote our message and why it is so important to be aware of the issues that animals face every day.
Yeah, that's
a great point, Katie.
Good summary. Well, I appreciate you both being here. So we've been talking to Katie Bester and Eric Sugarman. They are recent graduates of the Lewis and Clark Law School. And Katie has a certificate in animal law, and so does Eric, and also in environmental law. So I think this was a great show to explain to people about animal law and its impacts, and I really appreciate you being here, and congratulations on graduating, and hope your next chapter goes how you would like it to. And thanks for doing all of this hard work for the animals.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Yeah, thanks, Melissa. It's a pleasure to chat with you.
You're welcome. Same. Well, thank you both for being here, and we will be back again next month, so make sure to tune in, and also make sure to support KBOO's spring membership drive focusing on the postmodern, the avant-garde, and alternative. Become a member today at bit.ly/KBOO or show your support for community-focused, volunteer-powered radio like this show, That Vegan Show. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.
legacy? KBOO Community Radio invites you to a planned giving workshop with me, Tammy Caress, founder of Caress Law. Join us as we explore charitable and tax-saving techniques through your estate plan, empowering you to secure the future of independent media while leaving a legacy.